just as a business person and as a marketer, you got to recognize that names are important. They can hurt really badly if they are wrong, and they can help if they are right. And so to get it right, follow a process. Don't just kind of go into a room with a whiteboard and sticky notes and think you're going to solve it over a pizza with three smart people in the room.
Hey everyone, welcome to A Change of Brand, a show featuring behind-the-scenes stories of rebrand, glory, drama, or disaster. I'm your host, Blake Howard. As we get geared up for season 4, I thought it might be fun to record a more casual conversation about the difficult practice of naming. It's something we've touched on lightly in previous episodes, but we haven't spent a lot of time talking about it in general. Name changes are possibly one of the hardest things a brand can endure. No one likes new names. Maybe even more so than logos, we build an emotional attachment to the names of brands or products or services that we love. And over time, they become less about the literal words and they feel like a brand. Beyond the psychology of change, naming is incredibly subjective. On more than one occasion, I have seen great name candidates die because one stakeholder had some personal negative reaction to the word. That reminds me of my college girlfriend, or I had a childhood pet with that same name, so it's out. Naming is rife with subjective responses. It also comes with a litany of legal challenges and translation issues. Consider this. There are about 170,000 English words in common use today, but more than 1 million trademarks filed annually with the United States Patent and Trademark Office. So if you do the math, we are simply running out of words. Not to mention acquiring a reasonable URL is next to impossible these days. So for all of those reasons, I thought it would be fun to do an episode to go deeper on naming. Lastly, we don't always get to criticize on this show. I try hard to respect and honor all of our guests, and I don't want to overtly throw them under the bus or create some sort of takedown piece, even though that might make for a more entertaining episode. It's also hard for our guests sometimes to ever speak negatively about their employers or their client. So mining out the real story for you is difficult. Well, today's episode, we get to dodge all of that with third-party opinions and discussion. So we're going to bring a little respectful criticism. My guest is Rob Meyerson. He recently wrote a book titled Brand Naming. He's also host of How Brands Are Built and Principal of Heirloom. We sat down to discuss some of the biggest brand naming wins and fails. He brought a list of three best and worst, and I did the same. But first, I was curious, how did Rob become a naming guru?
So I suspect most people in the world had no idea that naming was a job, much less a career opportunity. In fact, I didn't even really know what branding was until I was finishing up some schoolwork and looking for what to do next. I had sort of decided I didn't want to go into academia, which had been the plan. And I was at one of those crossroads moments where, you know, what's next? And it was pretty wide open. And luckily I had a friend who worked in branding. She was at Interbrand, put me in touch with someone who needed some help there and was looking to make a sort of a part-time hire at first that turned into a full-time hire. And I really came in at the bottom of the totem pole, having no idea what I was doing. And just kind of dipping my toe into this whole world of branding. And luckily, I was in about a 20-25 person office of Interbrand in San Francisco. They had a 2-person naming team. And on a couple of assignments that I guess were especially challenging, they just felt like they needed a few more ideas. And so they put out an email to the whole office saying, hey, if anyone has time to generate additional ideas against this naming brief, have at it. And I think, you know, combination of things. I was trying to make a good impression at a new job, but also just sounded fun. I thought, okay, and, you know, I went home and came up with probably 50 ideas or something that I thought were brilliant. And they probably were all terrible, except luckily one of them was good enough for the head of naming, Andrzej Olszewski, at Interbrand San Francisco to just say he liked it. I don't even know if they presented it to the client, but that was kind of enough like validation or praise for me to think, okay, not only is this really fun, but maybe I could be good at it. And so I just kept trying to get up little opportunities like that for years as I worked my way up in really strategy roles at branding firms in California. And then I moved out to Asia and just did naming here and there. I moonlighted as a namer for other agencies and other companies sometimes. But when I finally came back to San Francisco in maybe 2011 or 2012, they were hiring for a head of verbal identity, which is what they call naming and messaging. And so I thought maybe I can take what I've been doing kind of as a part of my work as a strategist and make it everything I do and really focus on it. And that's when I really kind of zeroed in on naming, and the rest is history, I guess.
I love it. That's awesome. One little project where they just needed some extra ideas and extra help, and you got a little spark. You got a little excited of, wow, this is fun. People listening could probably recognize it is super hard. If you're a designer and you've ever been pulled in to a naming project, or maybe you're a strategist and you just get pulled into naming, or if you're an entrepreneur or even if you're a parent naming your child, you realize this is not that easy. So yeah. Let's talk just quickly before we get into some of the naming fails and wins. Why is it so hard? Why do consumers in particular respond so negatively to name changes?
Right. And it's one of those things where people only notice it if it's bad, right? Like that they'll respond really negatively to a name that they hate, but then a great name, it's not like people are out praising it on the internet or in the streets. It's just kind of the great names, they just don't have anything to say about. And I think it's similar for other creative work, to a lesser degree, maybe logos. You know, if it's a bad logo, people are going to blow you up on the internet. If it's great, you might get some praise, but, you know, mostly it kind of flies under the radar. Why is naming so hard? Partly because it's subjective. A lot of it is subjective, and people just have things that they love and hate, and it makes it really hard to make a decision when you're working with a client, because someone might hate something and not really even be able to articulate why, or it might be for some reason that really shouldn't impact the decision, but does. You know, maybe they had a girlfriend that had a name that sounded kind of like that, and you know, who cares? Nobody knows except you. So that's part of it. You know, the more logistical reasons naming is so hard is there's a lot of legal constraints. There are linguistic constraints, things that seem like great ideas until you find out what it means in Cantonese, or until you find out that another company has a trademark on that idea. That also makes it really, really hard. And then I do think, just going back to my comparison to logo design, one thing that makes it harder than some other aspects of branding is that, unlike design, everybody thinks that they're an expert when it comes to the English language, right? If you're an English speaker, a native English speaker, then it seems like, you know, there's only 26 letters. Like, I can be just as much of an expert as anybody else. Whereas with design, hopefully, you tell me, but hopefully there's a little more respect for the professional. Maybe not as much as we'd like, but a little more like, oh, I'll take your advice because you're an expert on design. But with naming, it's like, I could come up with something better than this, or you know, that's kind of the reaction sometimes.
Totally agree. I think that, you know, there's definitely a moment where some clients, usually the bad ones, we'll start to doodle or draw. Hey, what about this idea? I mean, we used to joke and say that's the kiss of death. Like, that's the worst moment.
Yeah.
So
they bite their lip and put whiteboard pen to whiteboard.
Yes, yes. And they do a magic sketch. What about this? But they can't get an illustrator and fine tune like the curve. And they can't really nail the execution. Where in naming, people think they can nail the execution because it's just, sure, it's just a word. You know, it's just part of the English language. So I totally agree that everyone thinks they can do it, or they at least think they can contribute ideas to it, and that can really muddy the waters.
It can. I mean, they can't, but they can contribute ideas. I think probably it is true that in naming, maybe more than design, there is a point in the process where the more the merrier, right? Like, sure, throw us your ideas. Unfortunately, a lot of clients' ideas, and it's not because they're clients, it's because anyone who's not spending hours and hours and hours thinking about this is going to throw you their first 10 ideas or even their first 50 ideas. And chances are, those are the same ideas everybody else had. And so they're not going to be available, or they're not going to be as interesting maybe as the ideas that you'll come up with when you have the experience, but also when you dedicate the time and effort and really kind of dig into a naming project, that's when you start to get some of the more interesting ideas.
Yeah. All right. Let's dig in to some fails or some wins. That'll be exciting. Hopefully none of my fails are in your win, or none of your wins are in my fail.
that'd be interesting.
That would be interesting. Yeah, I think we're good there though. But what do you want to start with first? Do you want to play good cop, bad cop? You want to be like cynical? You want to be celebratory? Where should we start?
Oh man, let's be mean first, right? And then we can end on a happy note that way.
All right, why don't you kick us off?
Sure. So in no particular order, I really just kind of listed these as they came to me. But a recent one that goes on my naughty list is Kindrel. So if you haven't heard of Kindrel, it's a B2B technology brand, which is probably why you haven't heard of it, but it was a spinoff or is a spinoff from IBM. And if you have heard of it, I'm guessing it's because the name was bad and it got some bad press. Like we were talking about, it's one of those things where people just jumped on it all over the news. People were writing articles about how gross it sounds, making fun of it on Twitter, how it sounds like a pharmaceutical. And it's one of those names, I think, like a couple on my list, that I'm sure there are other things wrong with it, but the sort of original sin here with this name is just that it sounds gross, which is admittedly suggestive or subjective. But yeah, that's, I think, the worst thing about it.
Yeah, there are certain syllables that create a certain reaction, and it's hard to get past the combination of syllables that create a certain feel or association with some other word. There was a project we worked on that was named, and we were handed the brief to bring the visual verbal identity to life. And it was a movie production studio just south of Atlanta. They film all the Avenger movies there. You know, Georgia film industry is really big. And the name is Trilith, T-R-I-L-I-T-H, Trilith. Brilliant in terms of they could get the trademark, they could protect it. It is also a real thing. It's like Stonehenge is a trilith. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a common, you know, it's a word, but it's not super common or known. But the syllables, my initial gut reaction was like the trill.
Yeah.
Like I just, there's something in that that kind of felt like nails on a chalkboard, but other people love it. And it's
a bit of a tongue twister too. And it makes it almost sound like you have a speech impediment, even if you're saying it correctly. So I think both Trilith and Kindrel, there's a namer named Alexandra Watkins who wrote another great book on naming, Hello, My Name is Awesome. And I think that's where I'm getting this. She has a thing in there that she calls the curse of knowledge, which is when we come up with names and it's almost like we're being a little too smart. And we have some cool fact that we know that we either knew or we found as we were doing, you know, research in the naming process. And we just can't get over how great we think it is, and it ends up in the name. So Trilith being a real word kind of doesn't matter at all, I don't think, because virtually no one in the audience for that name knows the word, I'm guessing. And so it feels like maybe they were being a little too cute with the meaning. Kindrel is, according to the press release that announced it, it's a combination of kin, as in family. And so it has that sort of sense of connection, I guess, which great. Not sure what the relevance is, but maybe there is some. And then the rest of the word is from tendril, which again, they're saying is about like points of connection. But tendril also, just as a word, sounds really gross. It has, I don't know, like sci-fi connotations for me, or just sounds like something gross. Yeah. And so I just don't know why, like, yeah, okay, you, they're either was a story that, and that's how you came up with the name. Or as we know, sometimes that story is post-rationalized. But either way, I just don't know why Tendril is something that you would want to associate with your name anyway. And then they went further and they changed the I's to Y's, which really enhances the degree to which this looks like a pharmaceutical or something out of Star Trek, some kind of like evil alien race. That's again, I don't know why they did that. Spelling does not often have that much of an impact on trademark availability. It may have been about getting the .com domain, which we can talk about that later if you want, but neither of those reasons to me justifies putting two Y's into a name. It just makes it so much uglier. And so another problem with this name is not only does it sound bad, but it looks pretty bad too, which you do need to consider when you're naming is just how is it going to look? And this one looks as bad as it sounds either. I want to say, Blake, I feel like we're really dogging this name and we're going to do this to some others too. All due respect to whoever came up with the name, as we talked about at the beginning, naming is really, really hard. And so I know we're being mean about the name, but if somebody hears this who worked on it, don't feel too bad. Like, it's a tough job, and sometimes feel like you're painted into a corner, and too many cooks in the kitchen, and you end up with something like this. So I hope we're not being too mean, but yeah, this name is definitely not a great one in my book.
Yeah, you never know what happened in the process. Yep. Just like anytime you criticize a logo, visual identity, you never know what the client really wanted to do. And I feel like nowadays, and this is more into like the pharmaceutical side, and maybe why that one sounds like a pharmaceutical, is it is just so hard to come up with a fabricated coined name because there are so many things being trademarked out there and you're just kind of running out of words.
Yeah.
So these pharmaceutical companies, they have to have something that's completely fabricated, that's not associated with anything else,
right,
which just ends up sounding, you know, strange, but it kind of has to be based on the criteria.
That's right. Yeah. Pharmaceutical naming, I don't envy the people who do that. I've never had to go through that myself, but I know there are extra regulatory constraints on what they're allowed to do. And that is why some of those, I get asked that a lot as a namer, you know, why are the drug names so bad? And that's a big part of it. I do feel like despite all those constraints, occasionally you'll see a drug name that is not so bad. Sometimes they're even pretty good. And so it makes me wonder. I mean, if somebody can do that occasionally, then there's proof that it doesn't always have to be so bad. But yeah, like you said, you never know what happened in the process. And so it's hard to judge too harshly from the outside.
All right. So one that I've got on my fail list to match is a little bit more of a rebrand story. But it's when Weight Watchers went to WW 2018, maybe 2017. And I just feel like it's confusing at best. That I understand the strategy of, at the time, weight was perceived as too limiting. So it's kind of like a descriptive name that they started to outgrow, essentially. And there are also... just some repositioning, the ownership had changed or a new CEO had come in, Oprah had invested, and it was like, they're still riding the wave of that. And I think they wanted to just broaden it more, you know, to be more about like a wellness company, which I love that idea and that strategy. I just think they went about it the wrong way. So shortening it to WW gets confusing with WWE or WWF. And there's just not a lot.
Right.
Maybe they felt like their equity in those W's was more than it really would, more than it really was, because I just don't know if you make the leap from Weight Watchers to WW and why not like Wellness Watchers or Well Watcher? Like there's other W's they could have just repurposed the weight word with. So yeah, man, it makes my naughty list for those reasons.
It's like the confluence of a couple of bad trends, in my mind, or bad practices. So one is, when you have an overly descriptive name, this happens a lot, right? Where companies feel like it's trapped years or even decades later and they want to change. So Pizza Hut has tried and failed a few times to get away from just pizza because they want people to know that they can go there for other kinds of food. Radio Shack tried to rebrand as The Shack because, I mean, that's not even, that's just because nobody, you know, has radios anymore. Radio Shack's got all kinds of problems. But yeah, so I get it. Just like you said, it's they wanted to be about more than that. And strategically, maybe that was the right idea. But then this other practice of taking a name and either, just abbreviating it somehow. And we've seen some brands like strip out all the vowels. And the issue I have is like with Weight Watch, I'm literally not sure if I was still supposed to call it Weight Watchers, but that was just their logo changed, or if I'm supposed to say WW, which is also really long when you say it out loud. They actually added a lot of syllables. And similarly with some of these other abbreviations, it really feels like brands are trying to have their cake and eat it too. Like, what are we supposed to call you now? And is it, you know, even BP saying that BP stood for Beyond Petroleum, it's like, it's a little too cute. And it leaves me not quite sure what they're trying to do. And yeah, it feels like they're trying to do two things at once, which is not, it's like the opposite of strategy or something. It's just a little vague. So yeah, I agree with you on that one being problematic. And I'm honestly still not sure. So are they Weight Watchers again now? I'm not sure what happened.
I think they're still WW. I did some research though, just in preparation for this, and they're down from what I could tell. They're down in top line revenue about 27% since 2018 when that name changed. So it feels like this could be one on the horizon where you see it be repurposed, or there's a new name, there's another name change, or it feels like something's got to give because it's just not working. But I think it's still WW. Like that's the. That's the brand. Right. That's the name.
That was a mistake.
All right, let's do some wins. Let's get more optimistic here and celebratory. What made your list on naming wins?
Sure. Well, I'll just list them all, but because two of them I think are not that surprising and they're big, well-known brands, we can talk about them. But the first was Virgin. I think a lot of namers love this one, although I don't hear it talked about that often. You know, it's a real English word. Super easy to pronounce, super familiar, but also very provocative, which I just think is great. Especially, you know, you have to remember that at the beginning, this was a record store or like a mail order record shop. They had probably a lot more permission to be provocative than if they started out as a multinational conglomerate. I doubt they would be able to get alignment on that name today. But I like that it is provocative, and you know, the story they tell around it is that they were kind of new to what they were doing and didn't know exactly what they were doing, so they were virgins in that sense. It wasn't necessarily meant to be sexual, although I'm sure they you know were having fun with being a little provocative in that way. Supposedly they had trouble with the censors in England with that name when they first tried to use it. I don't know if that's an urban legend. I feel like I should know, and I've probably looked it up before, but the way they supposedly got past that was by saying, yeah, it's not meaning it in the sexual way. It's in the way of, yeah, we're new to this. We're virgins in that way. So yeah, I think that's a great name. Another one is Kodak. Short, easy to say. It's coined, but there's really no question about how to pronounce it. And so I just think that's a great example of a name that does not have much meaning, but the founder liked the K sound and wanted something powerful that had that sort of heft to it and was easy to remember. And so I feel like that one also has worked really well and stood the test of time. But the one I'll talk a little bit more about is a newer name. It's Recess. And this is just one that I personally really love. It's a sparkling beverage, sparkling water. I think it's either always or sometimes CBD infused. So product aside, I just think that name, it's one of those real English words that it's suggestive. It's nostalgic, right? It makes you just think of being out on the playground. I feel like it evokes exactly what they want for this brand of sort of fun and sunshine and relaxation. with the, you know, the CBD aspect of it, obviously, making that kind of real in the product. It's a short, simple, easy word. I think it's unexpected in the beverage category. Nothing else like it that I can think of. Now there actually are a few. I think there's like a beverage called Day Trip, which is very similar. But Recess preceded that, and just I think has done a great job. And it doesn't hurt that from a design standpoint, the logo and the can design was also, I think, really, really strong and innovative at the time.
I love it. Yeah, that's a fun category to talk about. And Recess is, I love the name for all the reasons you said. I'm curious, have you seen the Liquid Death water brand?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, we definitely could have brought that one into this conversation, right? That's that's polarizing. I'm sure that could be on either list. No, I think it's brilliant. I mean, if anything, I feel like it's almost talked about too much in the branding community. It's become like, you know, almost like Apple, where everybody wants to compare themselves to it. It's just such a funny example of like a product that is, with all due respect, it's not that special, right? It's just water, but they just completely went nuts on giving it a brand personality. And it's not just the name and the personality. They've really kind of backed it up with some of the actual activities that they do and the things that they sponsor. They've really sort of built it around hard rock and extreme sports type, type events. So yeah, it's funny. I think it's a win, but I could definitely see people. I know a few people that have told me they hate it and they won't go anywhere near it because of that name.
Yeah, it is definitely polarizing. It's I mean, if you're gonna stand out in that category, you have to do something pretty radical. So I get it. I like it. I like it for those reasons. It's almost funny that it's so like it's so morbid sounding, and it's just water. It's like it's literally the most basic thing you can do, and it's called Liquid Death.
It's got the face melting sort of logo or icon on the can, and then I have to think this is part of where the name came from. They, at least originally when they launched, they had the like a tagline that was "Murder Your Thirst," which I almost think is better than the name. It's just that idea of
good. Yeah, just, it's really just good.
Kill your thirst.
Well, all right. I'll read through some of the ones that I had on my win list, and they're honestly, some of them are pretty cliche, so you'll have to suspend some of your judgment. But my first one is Häagen-Dazs ice cream. I have always loved this. I think the sound of it makes you feel like it's some remarkable, I don't know, little creamery from Denmark, and it's just been imported into the US. But the reality of the word is just, it was completely fabricated to sound basically like that. So I love it for those reasons, that it's just completely nonsensical, made up, but it makes me feel a certain way. So Häagen-Dazs made my list. And then I've got something that was more recent, because I was trying to find, you know, what is an example of maybe a larger organization that changed into a new name. And I really like the change from Square to Block for the parent company for Square, which they did, I think, in 2021. And I just love the connection where they went. There was only a few options. You know, it's like triangle, circle, parallelogram, maybe. Yeah. So Block was a pretty good answer, I think, given their choices.
Geometric.
But it just allows them to, you know, spread their corporate architecture more with different products and different services underneath it or whatnot. So I loved that name. And then the last one is like so cliche, but I still love it. I couldn't help it. When Google was originally named Backrub, and when I first thought of that, I was like, okay, that's got to be fake. I've heard that, but was it really named Backrub? And I looked it up, and in 96, it was. Larry Page's initial search engine was called Backrub, which Backrub is better than like Larry's Backrub, but Backrub is still... Yeah, that's a whole, don't Google that. Do not put that into your search.
Just sounds really creepy.
But you know, that's a pretty good jump. Backrub to Google, I applaud. So well done. Well done, Larry.
The rationale for Backrub, I believe, is that the technology used or the algorithm used was called a backpropagation network or neural network. Forgive my memory fail here on sort of the thinking behind that, but I think they took that word back and just tried to play with it. And yep. I guess Backrub is what they came up with. And yeah, it's a little off-putting. So yeah, Google has a great story too. I guess nowadays people seem to know this more, but for a long time people didn't know Google is a real number. It's one followed by 100 zeros. So it's this gigantic number. The reason it's called Google is because the mathematician's son, I believe, named it. The mathematician just said, I think just asked his son to come up with an idea for what to call this number. And that's what the kid came up with. I might be getting some of those details wrong. You'll have to forgive me. But yeah, it's something like that. And yeah, it's just so they took what was already a really fun word, G-O-O-G-O-L, totally playable in Scrabble if you're playing. And they just spelled it in arguably a easier to read way. So yeah, it works.
Yeah. I bet you're a beast in Scrabble. I mean, you like this is your is that true? Are you like undefeated in your family?
I'm okay. I'll tell you. Actually, I mentioned it in my book. I read a book 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, called Word Freak, which is a great book by a sports journalist about the competitive world of Scrabble. And I think he probably took this on almost as, you know, it's a funny thing to write a book about. But in the book, it almost transitions to like autobiographical because he gets obsessed with the competitive world of Scrabble and decides he wants to start playing. And as far as I know, he still plays competitively and he's pretty good. But what you learn in that book is that a lot of being good at Scrabble starts with just rote memorization of the playable 2 and 3 letter words. I started doing that a little bit. I memorized all the playable 2-letter words, which is not that hard because there's only about 100. And that made me a lot better than a lot of my friends for a while. But then I kind of forgot them and some of my friends started to catch up. And so I think I'm just okay. There is definitely an overlap, you know, just in kind of word nerdery and love of words between Scrabble and naming.
Pictionary is more my jam. Like if there's a Pictionary game, or Telestrations is one that I'm like, let's go. Come on, everyone.
Yeah, I just discovered that game like a couple of weeks ago. That one's fun.
It is.
Yeah. I do recommend having a Scrabble dictionary on hand if you're doing naming. I think it's a great asset because, of course, you want a dictionary for obvious reasons, but the Scrabble dictionary is limited to words that are about 8 letters long or shorter, and that's really good territory for coming up with brand names. So it can be a useful reference while you're coming up with name ideas.
I love it. That's awesome. All right, let's give the people what they want, and let's get into more of our snarky fails. What else do you have on your fail list?
Yeah, so the next one is Tronk, and this is one that featured heavily in the book as one of the bad names. Like Kindrel, it's mostly just sounds terrible. Tronk, like, rhymes with honky tonk, or it kind of sounds like trunk, which is not a great word, whether you're talking about an elephant or tree or the back of your car. It just doesn't have great meaning or visual associations. It is an abbreviation. We talked about WW, but Tronk stands for Tribune Online Content. TR from Tribune, ON from Online. And so it was also like, I think, kind of early .com era. I can't remember exactly. It may have been a little later, like the second, like 2.0. You know, it was really trying too hard to like sound cool and online and techie. And we can't show the logo on a podcast, but if you saw it, it totally does the same thing. It tries way too hard. It's got like little digital circuitry inside of a multicolored T and stuff. So it was just widely hated from the get-go. And I can happily report that this is one that was reverted to back to Tribune or Tribune Online Content after, I think, 3 to 5 years. You know, they had some reason, of course, like new ownership or something that they changed the name, but really it was just everybody hated it, I think.
Oh man, Tronk. Yeah, that doesn't make me feel great. Tronk.
Exactly.
It sounds like you're it's like you're trail running while drunk or something, tronk or it's got like a new category feel.
Yeah. And while we're talking about games like Scrabble, there's a game called Balderdash that I loved as a kid, which takes real but obscure words and you have to come up with fake definitions for them. It's really fun. But that's kind of a fun game to play with these made up names like Kindrel and Tronk. Maybe we should make that an exercise that we have to do on naming assignments, because that's a shorthand way to tell that this is not something you want to name your company after.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good segue into one that I had on my fail list. And it's somewhat known also. It's the Ford Pinto. So this is a more of a product kind of extension for this particular car. And specifically in Portuguese, it means Pinto means tiny male genitals. Roughly translated to little penis.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah,
the Ford little penis was not successful in the Brazilian market, you could say. So that's a good one. That's a little hat tip for some cultural testing.
Yeah, linguistic disaster check.
Yes,
exactly. Yes. It doesn't have, you know, now that I think about it, though, its meaning in English is not great. You know, it's like a pinto bean, or it's not like it's great. The famous story of... linguistic disaster, also a car, is the Chevy Nova that supposedly meant doesn't go in Spanish. But that one's definitely not true. That one is an urban legend. The Chevy Nova sold just fine in Spanish-speaking countries. They didn't even, you know, come up with an alternative name. Pinto, you know, I used to teach a branding class, and I had a Brazilian student. And she confirmed, you know, the meaning that it is slang and that would get laughed at. But I'm not sure what they did in Portugal and or Brazil, if they came up with an alternative name or if they tried to sell it as Pinto and it backfired. I don't know how much evidence there is of what actually happened there. But yeah, some of those stories are not true. Some are. But either way, it's a good reminder to do your checks before you launch something globally or in some country, or even in the US. I always tell my clients, in the US and other countries, it's not like a monolith in terms of language. There are all kinds of different languages spoken in the US. So you got to watch out. And Spanish spoken in New York versus LA versus South America versus Spain, there's all kinds of different slang and it changes year to year. So you got to be careful.
All right. What else do you have on your fail list? You're number three, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So my last, these weren't necessarily in order, but my last bad name, I wanted to kind of mix it up. So we had Kindrel, which is coined, and Tronk, which is an abbreviation. The last one is Real Words, Pearl Milling Company. And that was the recent rebrand of Aunt Jemima, right?
Yeah.
You know, first off, I want to be clear, Aunt Jemima should have, that name was long overdue for a change. It arguably should never have existed. Even I think long after people realized how offensive it was, or I should say more people realized how offensive it was, it stuck and it shouldn't have. So kudos to the company, I guess, better late than never for changing the name. But man, you'd think they could have come up with something better after having decades to think about it. So they changed it after George Floyd's murder. This was in the wake of that. A lot of companies changed names or moved away from racist and offensive mascots or logos or names. I can't remember how quickly they changed. I think they were one of the ones that came out quickly and said they were going to change. But a lot of these companies, you know, they took their time changing. And Pearl Milling Company is super long, super boring. Does, you know, for using real words, it really does not tell you anything about the product. It doesn't imply anything positive. You know, it has historical significance, but a little bit, again, like that curse of knowledge that I mentioned earlier for Trillith that you brought up. You know, they know that Pearl Milling Company is, you know, has historical relevance to the syrup and the product and the company behind it, but nobody else knew or knows what that is. And, you know, they really missed an opportunity. They took something that while it was very offensive, had a brand, you know, that was distinctive and had personality. And they just, they stripped all that out and made it completely devoid of meaning or personality.
Yeah. That one is a difficult one, because you get the sense that they just wanted to play it so safe that it was such a reactionary process that whoever the decision makers were not going to risk any sort of criticism of it being misconstrued one way or another in it. And you get a sense that it means virtually nothing and is just three very normal, boring words. And even on the design side, you know, the design sort of went that route where they kept some of the colors in place and they tried to create some visual recognition, but man, it's pretty right down the middle.
Yeah, I agree. They probably were rightly kind of scared to put their foot in their mouth again with something that was even worse. Or I mean, that's why there's a case to be made. They should have changed it a long time ago, before they got into this position where they felt like they had to try so hard to make it devoid of meaning. You know, there are plenty of ideas that are inoffensive, but also not super boring. And I would say that some of the sports teams, I know that they've gotten a lot of negative, you know, people react strongly to these name changes, especially when it's a sports team, because it's so emotional. But the Cleveland baseball team changed to the Guardians, the Washington football team changed to the Commanders. And surely lots of people hate those names. At least they're not offensive and they still sound like sports teams. Pearl Milling Company does not sound like syrup or anything that anyone would really want to buy, I don't think.
Yes. Well, speaking of appealing but being really unappealing is my third, and not in any particular order either, but a name that is almost, in my mind, it had to be folklore, but I looked it up and confirmed it. So there was a name, there was a company that's been around since the 60s, and they did not change their name until recently, but for a long time, their name, this is a B2B company, was Anal Tech, A-N-A-L-T-E-C-H. And
wow.
Yes. I realized that two of my three bads reference anatomical parts, which is maybe an issue.
Well, I mean, yeah, well, I think that's a good watch out for anyone doing naming, though.
Yeah. I mean, that's generally the role of a creative director with logo design as well. It's like you just try to make sure it's not overly
it
phallic.
It doesn't look like part of the body.
That's part of the goal. But yeah, so they had been around since the 60s. And I looked up the history of them. They're a manufacturer and distributor of pre-coated plates and equipment for sample preparation of thin layer chromatography, or TLC. I had to look that up. What does that mean? So it's dealing with chemical elements in their purest form, like 24 karat gold is almost a pure substance. And if it is almost a pure substance, it's called an analyte. So that's where it came from. It was analyte technology, but they dropped the ite and they went with the anal. And man, that's just a rough one. So I found a survey from 2009 that the company issued, and they asked the public, should we change our name? And there was like the history of the name, and then there was a link to click on a survey to say yes or no. And you know, they actually changed their name. They rolled out the new name, and it's Pen 15. That's actually the new name.
Pen. No, it's not.
Sorry, terrible joke. Pen 15 is not Pen 15. I don't know what the new name is, but they apparently changed it. So you can Google it and find it for yourself.
It's hilarious that, because you said they deal with like purity. So it sounds like they're obsessed with purity, which is kind of being anal. So it sounds like maybe that's how they came up with the name. Like they're super, super anal about making sure you get your 24 karat gold.
That's perfect. Yeah. You said earlier, some name justification or rationale is like post concept. So you're so good at that. Like on the fly, you just help them justify it.
Yeah, they should have said we're keeping our name, but now it just means that we're, yeah, that's like a, it's a selling point. We're super anal about our product being the best out there.
Oh, that's amazing. That's too good. Yeah. Well, Rob, thank you for your wins and your fails. Just as we wrap up here, what are like your closing thoughts on themes to help people stay in the wins column and help people avoid being in the fail column? What's a way to like wrap up just from a high level theme perspective to keep more wins and less fails?
Well, oh man, it's hard for me to keep it short on this because I feel like I have so much to say about it. But I hope that people listening, if they're not that familiar with naming, have at least familiarized themselves with some of the pitfalls and the fact that this can go very, very wrong if you're not careful. And so my first bit of advice is just to take it seriously. I mean, you know, it's not, I don't mean to overstate how serious of a thing branding even is at the end of the day in the grandest scheme of things in the world. Just as a business person and as a marketer, you got to recognize that names are important. They can hurt really badly if they are wrong, and they can help if they are right. And so to get it right, follow a process. Don't just kind of go into a room with a whiteboard and sticky notes and think you're going to solve it over a pizza with three smart people in the room. Follow a process, generate hundreds of ideas, you know, look at pre-screening them for legal availability and linguistic viability kind of early in the process so that you don't go too far down the road on names that you can't have or that mean genitalia in Portuguese. Failing all else, hire a professional or buy a book about naming and get into the details.
Man, I was hoping you'd bring up the book because that was a softball question to share more about the book. Like the one thing you can do is actually buy the book. I love it. We will link to it in the show notes for folks to quickly find.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right, Rob, thanks so much. Appreciate your time. A lot of fun.
Yeah, I had fun, Blake. Thanks. And talk to you soon.
All right. Okay, that's a wrap. Special thanks to Rob Meyerson. Be sure to check out his book, Brand Naming, wherever you get books. To see more visuals from some of the brands we referenced in today's episode, head on over to achangeofbrand.com. And as I mentioned, stay tuned for season 4. We have some fantastic stories lined up, and it might be our best season yet. Be sure to follow us on Instagram to stay in the loop. It's just @achangeofbrand. Today's episode was edited by Gabe Kitzman, and artwork was created by Rachel Jackson. I'm your host, Blake Howard, signing off.